And that was, who was that?
Todd Rundgren, Love of the Common Man.
Todd Rundgren, Love of the Common Man. Very, very good title for what we're about to talk about for the next 2 hours. The Common Man rising up and taking power, basically, and we love that. So this is Socialist Alternative Radio. Thank you to Ear Buddies. And everyone's cool now for the next semester or more here at WMFO with a new schedule. Check us out. Lots of new shows, great shows. Tufts Freeform, Educational Radio, et cetera, et cetera. And we are legally known as WMFO Medford. That's WMFO in Medford. And if you want to listen by your radio, if you're lucky enough to get the station, the signal out in the airwaves, out in the real world, go to 91.5 FM. WMFO at 91.5 FM, or listen by computer at WMFO.org. And if you're listening live and streaming, that's great, WMFO.org, or you can use that for the archive function and get the last one or two shows that have been on the air. And so today, for the next 2 hours, is Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working class. And we have a lot of complaints today, the working class, democratic, socialist, talking music from a working class, democratic, socialist perspective. That's our tagline, and I have it memorized, and I don't want to screw it up. So today, your hosts, co-hosts today are myself, Jeff, and...
Diego.
Diego is back, and and we're mad as hell and won't take it anymore. Okay, you're going to hear some crinkling now over the air. That's bad form, but I got to get... Got to get some CDs, old school CDs out. Did you hear that Best Buy is and Target are not going to sell CDs anymore soon?
I'm surprised they still do.
Well, yeah, that's one reaction. I agree, that is a bit surprising they still do. But
you can get a lot of CDs at the library now. It's like,
well, yeah, and I personally still buy them like for gifts and stuff. Like I bought my son. Like who's 12 and not the least bit interested in the kind of music I listen to. I bought him The Clash and Creedence Clearwater Revival, and I said these are two things I listened to a lot back in the day and still do.
Why don't you listen to them? What would I buy? Oh my god!
So Justin, open those CDs up that you haven't opened yet. Last night I saw he hadn't opened them yet.
Here's the first Wu Tang. Open that 36 chamber.
yeah. There you go. So I don't know. I don't like this. Like everything under capitalism, we don't choose. They claim we have a choice through consumerism, and it's a lie. It's a complete lie. They give you a very narrow parameter of choice, and you think that's real choice. But where's the vote for getting rid of CDs? Where's the vote for getting rid of vinyl? Where's the vote for getting rid of 8-track tapes? I know that's a bad example because nobody liked 8-track tapes that much. But, so...
You didn't like them. I loved them.
Well, I used them, but I'm just saying they were kind of clunky.
My mother had an old stereo systems from the 60s that had a little, it had an option back then. It was 8-track and vinyl.
Yeah, well, I knew people that were listening to... tape. I don't know how to explain it. That just regular like tape recordings that used to be voice recorded tape before digital.
Yes.
You know the I'm lacking the word, the exact word.
Maxwell and
The tape that was actually a thing. You know,
the small ones, right?
Yeah. Yes. Well, or big ones, and they were such music aficionados or whatever. They were so into pure sound that it was like there was recording studio quality tape. I don't know. Again, I'm lacking the right vocabulary. Yeah. So anyway, today's show on Socialist Alternative Radio, in my head at least, it's kind of going to be a show that's a lot about myth busting. A lot of capitalist mythology is out there, and if you dig hard enough and you do the research, often you can find, although it takes a lot of work, capitalist sources that contradict each other and bust their own myths. We're also going to talk about, as we do every show, because we're not just about alternative information and progressive socialist news and information. We're about getting you involved, hopefully, in the socialist movement. And actually, believe it or not, there is a socialist movement, and actually doing things, doing political work that goes beyond single issue advocacy and certainly goes beyond voting for the two corporate political parties, the Republicans and the Democrats. We also have a new issue of Socialist Alternative. If we have time, we're going to get into that and some good stuff in it. And what happened to my...
What do you think about the Olympics?
I think nothing about the Olympics. What do you want? What do you want to say? I actually am ignoring the Olympics completely.
These right wingers are just drumming away like we need to go on nuclear war. These guys before they hit us. Yeah. Blah 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 blah.
Yeah. I heard a thing on the radio on the way in. There's a
how dare the North Koreans have a delegation there? Yeah. They're gonna play too, and they forced themselves to play in there. Really?
Yeah.
Really?
At Boston.
That was the whole point of the Olympics.
Yeah.
Even under Nazi Germany had the Olympics.
Yeah.
You know?
At Boston College, there's a radio station. And they have a sort of progressive news thing going on Sunday mornings, where, and it's usually taped speeches by people and stuff. So they had Daniel Ellsberg on, the guy that was famous for the Pentagon Papers. He leaked information back then that would have put him in prison. Back then, he managed to not go to prison, and he's written a new book about the dangers of nuclear war. That sounds a little strange to people because they think that's all like sort of in the past, although the recent Korea stuff reawoke that fear, and it's a good fear to have. People should be really afraid of nuclear power and the pollution and radiation from that, and the weaponization of nuclear power components, and also nuclear war, and also uranium mining actually is extremely dangerous. But nuclear war, of course, threatens the entire species, you know, or most of it, or all of it. And in fact, my speaking of my son again, he's really into this show recently called The 100. It's one of the many, many different shows out there now that are being produced by TV stations, and there's like serial shows they run for seasons, and their storylines are connected and so on. You know what I'm talking about, like every, like The Wire. Mm-hmm. You know, the first couple were like The Wire and others, Sopranos and stuff, and now that's all over the place. If you get Netflix, you have a choice of many, many shows.
Have you
shows.
Watched any of the Gotham stuff?
I didn't like it. I started really? Watching, didn't like it, yeah.
It was better than Batman, all the movies combined,
yeah,
I think.
Really? Yeah, yeah.
Anyway.
I don't know. Yeah, no, you're probably right. I probably didn't give it enough time, but The 100 is about a post-nuclear apocalypse America, which I think is a little set in America. Yeah,
it's
The 100.
Out there.
Yeah, and it's a little it's always in its like fifth or sixth season. You only can get four seasons on Netflix. But anyway, it's very interesting because I think it actually paints a picture of survival that's a little too rosy for the reality of nuclear apocalypse. But it also does keep coming up with new dangers that the survivors face from everything from the man-made to the environment and so on. It's very, very interesting. And,
it doesn't get into the Mad Max kind of thing.
It does, yeah. It's got kinda a little bit of the Mad Max thing, which there's from some portion of the survivors that are there. But it's just it's an endless it's a interesting plot with a lot of variations that could happen and are happening to it. And they're not afraid to kill off some of the main characters, which is always interesting. I think that's kind of realistic. Anyway, so that the whole point is that the fear of nuclear Armageddon, nuclear apocalypse, nuclear war is coming back, and I think that's a good thing, and I think it exposes the insanity of capitalism as a system. If you go deep enough into your analysis, it's not just a couple crazy people like Trump or whatever. It's like systematic, and Ellsberg was making that point. He says this goes back to Eisenhower and Kennedy. Those two administrations developed the mutually assured destruction garbage that's out there. And everyone's stuck to it ever since, you know? And, of course, you had before that Truman actually dropping atomic weapons twice mm-hmm. on civilian populations in two Japanese cities, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So the United States has blood on its hands and then started the whole thing and isn't talking at all about disarming, but only instead of upping the ante now.
Now they're talking about arming Japan to defense against North Korea.
Yeah, and that's I think that's
like literally have like they did in Turkey during the Soviet Union. Just give them all these Persian.
And look at Turkey now. Turkey's a dictatorship, killing Kurds, imprisoning a big portion of its
Armenians.
Population because they almost had a revolution or a coup recently.
The PPK, persecution of the PPK, and blaming everything on them when sometimes it's not really them.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's another thing. Yeah, the whole militarization thing. But I'm just talking for a second just about nuclear war stuff. And it's gotten to the point where, as we just talked about, they are Trump administration. And, of course, not just Trump. Remember that. Trump is a symptom. The disease is capitalism, you know. And Trump is talking about the Trump administration is talking about amping up nuclear weapons. And they paint this picture when Trump speaks. It's so insane because he paints the U.S. military as some sort of underdog. We're not going to be bullied. We're not going to let this happen to us. We're going to take care of our military. What alternative universe is this guy in? The U.S. military is 18 times stronger than the next closest military or militaries combined. It's got bases in hundreds of countries. It's got, or 150 or 140 or something like that. It's got special... ops forces, you know, the kind that just go in and shoot everybody when they break into a building. And I heard today they were in 150 countries. Like that recent one, some were killed in Niger. In Africa, and nobody knew they were there.
I heard about that, yeah.
And there's so much money. Half of your taxes is going into the military. Now, don't get us wrong. We're not arguing.
And then they got the mercenaries that you don't know about.
Subcontractors, yeah.
Just like they did in Angola during the Angolan Revolution.
I mean, don't get us wrong. We're not arguing that... you just cut the military budget and everything is solved under capitalism. Not at all. But you could get some significant reforms. Again, all reforms temporary under capitalism because of the class struggle ongoing. But you could get some significant reforms by cutting military spending a lot. And it could be cut a lot without anyone really even noticing. And I was thinking, how would you propagandistically fight both Democrats and Republicans who would defend the military pig fest that's going on, the military, you know,
industrial complex, you know,
industrial complex, and all the money involved that they'll fight to the death for. Well, one thing is to I think a workers' party or a socialist party would have to put forward some sort of jobs program for any soldiers would be laid off in the process of cutting the wasteful military spending.
Retool. And
that would be
retool.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what the Cuba did when they had to slash their, you know, they said, well, we're gonna use the military and retool towards agriculture work.
Uh-huh.
Things like that.
Yeah.
Have them do agriculture or building or, you know, all these trades that help society while you're in peacetime.
And I would argue
as opposed to
So you have to put forward a massive jobs program for any military personnel that would lose their positions, voluntary, you know, jobs program. And if and with jobs the secured would be at higher pay than the military. Like you'd have to actually create new jobs. The government would, which is easy to do, create new jobs and pay union rates, because military pay is very low, union rates of pay and benefits. That would be part of the structure, guaranteed. And that would entice a lot of military people to be like, yeah, I don't want this. I don't want this military life. I want a regular job.
But also they pay low, but they say, oh, they pay low, but we don't get taxed. We get exempt. Things like that.
Well, last I've checked in, there's a lot of people in my family.
Maybe
were
not
the,
all.
A lot of people in my family were in the military, and I was in ROTC for a year before I thankfully got out. Last time I checked in, it was low pay. Maybe that's changed. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I predict it's still low pay. And I certainly see a lot of people leaving the military that end up homeless and stuff.
No, but I know a lot of people in the military would say it's low pay, but it's not taxed.
Well, a lot of people,
you know, things like that.
A lot of people, and I'm not blaming them for this. I understand it. I probably do it myself sometimes. They like to rationalize and make excuses for the situation they're in. They don't. Who wants to go around and say, I'm screwed, I'm in a rotten job, and I hate it? Instead, they'll say, things are going pretty well. Yeah, yeah. I got this. Americans are trained to do that. Let's face it. Americans are trained to put a smiley face
on everything. Was it George Carlin when he goes, like, Americans, when it comes to, we just, like that, we roll over like
All that's Americans being so brave. Man, I never see so much submission in my life when it comes to the workforce. Partially because I don't blame individuals so much as the lack of unionization and the continuing lesser evil empowerment of the Democratic Party, which is a corporate party, and just makes things harder for the left, makes things harder for unions to really grow. And so I don't necessarily blame people individually, but let's face it, our individual psyches or whatever, our individual ways, worldviews are shaped a lot by capitalist propaganda and all sorts of corporate values. Like now that's all this wellness stuff. You've heard about that term, wellness?
Mm-mm.
Wellness is just a fancy word for like...
I thought that was a Rite Aid thing.
Yeah. Well, it's a very flexible term. It usually means a corporate-based strategy for brainwashing the workers. They don't call it this, of course, but it's brainwashing the workers into accepting things as they are, and things as they are getting worse. But to do that with a mind, a focused mind, and a calmness, and all this other crap.
So it's like New Age psychology. So we are going a Demolition Man path. Remember Demolition Man, the movie?
Yeah, I think I saw that.
Be well. Remember? You couldn't shake. You had to be well. You know, don't eat red meat.
That's coming up. Yeah. That's right. That's a good analogy. And so it's like, when they talk about their jobs, they try to make it sound really interesting and it's going really well. And I don't have this, but like you were saying, maybe I have low pay, but it's not taxed. And everyone's always making excuses for rotten situations that instead they should be angry about and should be trying to change. But I understand
how would it be in France?
The path to being an activist is not a smooth one. And they make it so it's not a smooth one.
How would that be?
By the way, we can make it in Socialist Alternative. We can make it smoother than you think. In France, from when I was living there, the go-to position, the default position, is not one of relentless optimism and smiley face. It was
I think it's the same everywhere.
It was a little sad, a little depressed, and a little angry, yeah. And more class consciousness, because you had not those French are any smarter. I believe intelligence is more or less equalized, and situational.
It's universal.
And of course, yeah. And so but they do have an advantage over us, which is, as working people in France, they have the big workers' parties, the Communist Party, the Socialist Party, although that's totally sold out, obviously. Other left-wing parties, a stronger labor movement because of those workers' parties, and a history of struggle. You know, they're the ones that got rid of the royalty in France. You know, so people remember that. The French Revolution. And you even have the French bourgeois, the French educational system, kind of like, at times trying to hide that history or downplay it or attack it even. But yeah, the French got rid of the royalty. And
the sky didn't fall afterwards.
In 1968, they almost had a revolution, which a lot of people don't know about. A biggest general strike in history up until maybe recently. There was a bigger one in India. I'm not sure about the pure numbers, but in terms of political power and probably numbers, it was the biggest general strike in history in 1968. And there's all sorts of things in French history that have, even recent protest movements that have been large enough that people kind of feel like, if I'm really angry, I can go out on the streets about this. Although there is also protest fatigue sets in. Protests don't last forever. It'd be a different response in France. How's your job going? They might complain about what the constraints on their job. Even if you're talking to a upper middle class person, they might I knew a couple doctors when I was living there, and they would complain, and they had a better healthcare system, but they would be like, we're not getting enough funding, that kind of thing. Whereas here, man, it's like you talk to a doctor and they'd probably look at you strange if you said, hey, this system sucks, by the way, and you're a tool, and we need Medicaid for all. We need socialized medicine. We need socialist medicine. What do you think? They'd be like, next, here's some meds. Here's some pills you can take, and we'll see you tomorrow or see you next week. But don't forget your $25 copay. It just went up another $5. I have about 10 things I could go to the doctor for, and I don't want to spend the $25. So, this whole thing about preventative medicine is a complete joke. When you've upped the copay to the point that people have to think twice about it, because I have to save every penny. I have a family. We're living on the edge, man, and it's a rotten system here. But how many people think when they're talking about work to criticize the system in America? They're usually taught. We're taught. And again, I'm not saying this from a position of I'm all wise or whatever. I had to learn this stuff myself, and I did learn it at a young age, thankfully. But I learned it. That it's not you, it's the system. Now, a lot of other people would go to their grave. I mean, they would literally froth at the mouth at that and say, no, it's the person. If you just work hard enough, you'll. And the reality is, statistically, no, you can work. The people that work the hardest in this country are the poorest. Come on, who are you talking about? Hard work.
I had three jobs and I'm still.
Yeah, we're going to talk about your taxes in a minute. Yeah. And you got and I have good.
And that was dialectical materialism. Yeah. I blame the system.
Yeah. And there's people I love who just can't. They just take that capitalist brainwashing and they just can't get over it, man. It's like, if they believe in the meritocracy, even if they aren't experiencing it, and they blame any glitches on immigrants or whatever, and they're just out to lunch when it comes to politics. They don't understand how the system works. And again, fundamentally, I don't blame them because under, you know, as Marx said, the ruling ideas of any age are the ideas of the ruling class. So most people are going to have a default of the capitalist system in their heads, you know, capitalist values. However, enough of us get over that, and other people, even you, another thing is, you learn quickly as an activist, is that people can have simultaneously in their consciousness incredibly backward ideas and incredibly progressive ideas in the same brain, in the same conversation.
Same sentence.
And that's unfortunate because, you know,
like one guy, he was saying something, then he said, damn dreamers. And I was like, that was in one sentence. You just went from, and you lost me.
Yeah. Yeah, that happens a lot to me.
It's just like, I give up.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. But
with conversations in Cuba, it's more like, wow, interesting. You know, it's like a chest. You know, it's like, you know, maybe I don't know if it's because people are more laid back there or something, but it's just like.
Problem, though, Cuba's changing. And not that we like the where it was, but it's changing even to get worse in some ways. And I don't know. My take on Cuba, and of course you've been there and I haven't, but I hear stuff from people that have come back, is that there's a lot of people there scrambling for money, for every penny. And they and by the way, when they see a tourist or an American, they spend a lot of time trying to get money off them. A lot of effort, a lot of energy. So that doesn't signal to me a healthy environment where people can talk leisurely, but maybe there's still a lot of people that can, which is good. We have no leisure time here.
Well, it depends. If you're in the city like Havana, that's different than the countryside where mostly...
Yeah, where you mostly go.
Yeah. People still have the old styles from like even 1800s, like, you know.
Yeah. And, I don't know. I don't want to get into Cuba because it's just a lot to talk about, but it is a lot of contradictions. And some, you know, the healthcare and the literacy is great, but they never had workers' democracy, and that held back even what they could accomplish on a single island. But overall, you can't have socialism in one island. Sorry. Or in one country. And anyone that thinks that, it's like they call the capitalist media now, including national propaganda radio, they call Venezuela socialist routinely. And I'm like, what?
I've heard communist straight up, flat out.
That's, or really?
That regime, the communist regime.
I mean.
It depends on how right wing.
No, I'm talking about liberals say this. I'm talking about liberals say
this. Okay, liberals say that, but there's because I like to watch both sides. I like to see what the perspectives are.
I do too.
And there's one channel
I don't like
called
it, but
Newsmax,
I do it.
Which is, you know, the Trump supported, you know, networks.
Yeah,
whatever.
Yeah.
They'll say flat out, Venezuelan communist regime. They won't call the country, but they'll say the regime, the country's under a communist regime.
Well, I heard a liberal call Venezuela socialist the other day, and I said, would you please get a dictionary out and look up what socialism means, because it doesn't fit that at all. You know, the economy, there's so much of the economy in Venezuela that's in private hands. It's ridiculous. You know, just because they nationalized the oil industry.
I mean, if they were really socialist, you think these guys, the people that go on strike, they're funded by the corporations linked in with the United States, would not be going on strike because it would be under workers' control.
Yep, exactly.
That wouldn't be the case, that these truckers are not supplying the food market. Kind of like what happened in Market Basket, you know?
Yeah, and even if it was a version of socialism, even if it was Stalinist or something, that would be... a completely different story than the reality. I mean, it would be, you'd have the economy under public ownership, or at least under state control. And what kind of workers' government you have and so on would be the crux of it. Like, Cuba never achieved a workers' government, a workers' democracy. That is a huge problem, and that makes it not really socialism. But, you know, if someone calls Cuba socialist, I kind of understand that, even though it's really not. Mm-hmm. But it does have, like, a bureaucratically planned economy, or did until recently. And I don't know how much is private sector now in Cuba, but there it's expanding. But in Venezuela, are you kidding? The private sector never even took a hard hit. You know, they got oil. That's it. The government took over the oil industry. That's it, man. And maybe a few other things here and there. But there was well documented examples, even under Chavez, of people that would like take over land for land reform, and the government would force them to give it back.
Agrarian reform.
I mean, they have some social welfare. I don't know how much it's still intact, but they had some social welfare around medicine and basic food subsidies that you could call socialistic reforms, I guess. Mm-hmm. But that's the whole, you know, most people didn't live off that.
Yeah, there was bodegas where you can go in and buy food at half the price you would somewhere else in the upper class areas of Caracas, you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
And it was funny because, you know, you have these rich people going, oh, let me go over here because they weren't discriminatory. Oh, you're rich. You can't come into this bodega.
No, they're,
and they would buy it for less than they would in their, you know, where they live next to that whatever market.
Yep. Well, the rich led a
even though they're badmouth Chavez. Yeah.
The rich
they don't mind the programs. Yeah.
The rich led a huge protest movement. Well, I don't know if it was huge, but it was big. And the bourgeois here, the ruling class here, was putting a lot. I would say probably putting a lot into that secretly with the CIA and everything. And they were very hopeful about it, and it never went anywhere. And then next elections they had, the exact opposite happened. This is recently. Maduro's party gets a lot of people reelected right after this huge protest movement that we were led to believe in the United States was very, very popular, and Venezuela is on the brink. And then the corporate media just shut up after that for a while. Now they're back. Venezuela.
So the people there got bamboozled.
More sanctions.
In other words,
blah, blah.
Venezuelan people were.
Well, we got bamboozled.
Are not bamboozled.
Right.
They're still sticking to their guns.
Somewhat, yeah. Well, their guns are changing, unfortunately. I don't think Maduro has a way out, but you're right. Whereas where here we were taught, oh, this is, you know, I remember hearing a lot all of a sudden in the corporate media about Venezuela, seeing a lot, hearing a lot. And after that movement died down and after the elections repudiated the entire model, false propaganda model they had set up for us, they just kind of shut up for a while. Now they're back at it again.
And then you had Honduras, Trump, which is, you know, another, like, okay, now let's focus on Honduras.
Yeah, what happened to that movement in Honduras? Right. We mentioned that on the show.
That guy's still in power. That's Uncle Puppet.
Rigged election. That's another thing about the liberal, you know, we could go on all day about the liberal media, but I'll just say one
thing.
And
I have friends from Venezuela. One guy who works with me, he's talking to his mother. They're in fear that they might go to the dollar like the El Salvador.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's it. That's it for Honduras. If they go dollar, this is going to be like the Puerto Rico, you know, in Central America.
Right.
First, it's El Salvador. It's like a domino effect.
Yeah, exactly. And, well, it's also just capitalism using its power, not necessarily just military, to keep these countries, you know, under their thumb, you know, to exploit and to not cause trouble and instability from their point of view, the capitalist point of view and all that. But what was I going to say about the...
Honduras.
No, Honduras. There was something else.
Venezuela.
I'm sorry, I can't remember. It was something about the... Anyway, we'll get back to it maybe. So, like we promised... some myth busting here. This really blew my mind. Now, don't take this the wrong way. This is from the New York Times, February 8th, by someone named Patricia Cohen. And it said, quote, and let me know what you think about this, Diego, if you've heard of this before. We all have a stake in the stock market, right? Guess again.
No.
Okay. No, right. Okay. So no. My inclination was always to say no, that all the propaganda about Americans now all are in the stock market, either directly or through retirement plans and all that.
IRAs and
that I always leaned against that. I always pushed against that, but I didn't have a lot of data. And this is a very recent study that shows the following. This is huge. Most families in the United States own little or no stock. 84% of all stocks owned by Americans belong to the wealthiest 10% of households. So it's even, you know, more limited than I thought. And that includes everyone's stakes in pension plans, 401ks, individual retirement accounts, as well as trust funds, mutual funds, and college savings programs like 529 plans. So that this research was far-reaching. It thought of any way you could be even connected to the stock market. Because, like, if you don't own stock through your pension plan or IRA, right, you don't really own it. But when they're propagandizing about the stock market and capitalism, they make it sound like you directly own something through that.
You have a stake
in here. Yeah, yeah. And you don't. You don't control that at all. But this study went and took all that propaganda in and said, okay, by your terms, there's different ways you can be part of the stock market. We'll give you that. Let's look at it. And it still came out that hardly anyone had. Very few Americans have stocks. Roughly half of all households don't have a cent invested in, this is a quote, don't have a cent invested in stocks, whether through a 401k account or shares in General Electric. That leaves half the population with some exposure to financial market whims in terms of households. But that exposure, some exposure, can be just like $100 or something. So another sort of angle on it. And if you look at it in terms of big chunks of stock, it gets very, very narrow. So you got half with zero, and then you have within that other half most with almost nothing. Now, the article where it falls apart, in my opinion, is it makes this point that the fluctuations in the stock market don't matter to the average American, therefore. And I understand that argument on a superficial level. I would say, yeah, because we don't own anything that they think we own, that they propagandize that we own. But obviously, the capitalists will make decisions that we don't make because it's capitalism. Capitalism is the complete lack of democracy. It's a dictatorship of big business. There's no democratic decision-making in terms of economic decisions, unless there's pressure put on the government or something. But those are a lot of decisions are private corporations or stockholding corporations making these decisions with no input from the public, no voting, whatever. So, they can make these decisions totally based on their own interests, and if they're losing money in the stock market, they're going to take it out on us. They always do. You know what I mean? And they're going to extrapolate from the loss of the stock market. They're going to make things up and say, this requires us to do X, Y, or Z, or this is because you're getting more money. Like look at the propaganda around why the stock market is volatile lately. Oh, because wages are going up. You got to check that. Because what kind of figures are you using? Using average wages? So some boss somewhere got an increase, you're going to throw that in the pie? Because for most workers, wages still aren't going up. And other economists, capitalist economists, are saying that as well. Anyway, back to the question of stocks. If you look at where the money is really held in terms of stocks, it's among the top 10%. If you break it down by age, race, and education, and parental education, you'll see the disparities are even larger. Parents who lack a four-year degree and later on their children are much less likely to have a direct stake in the stock market than college graduates. Blacks and Hispanics are much less likely than whites. Most households had less than $5,000 in total holdings in 2016. That's like those statistics that have come out recently that if there's an emergency, how much do most Americans have to deal with that? And it's like zero or something, you know?
Yeah.
So this is a similar statistic. Most households had less than $5,000 in total holdings in 2016, the most recent year analyzed by, and they quote the guy who did the study, someone named Wolf, W-O-L-F-F. Despite the slow recovery in housing prices, the wealth of middle class, that's a misnomer, but middle class Americans, is still concentrated in their homes, which remains their single most valuable asset. But as we know, home ownership is declining in the United States, you know? And I would argue also that home ownership is very precarious. We don't have the mass foreclosures. Well, there are still a lot of foreclosures, but we don't have like this, you know, a burst in them, an abnormal period of them. Well, let me strike that. We don't have the as many foreclosures as during, you know, right after during the Great Recession and afterwards, you know. But there's still a lot of them happening, and I can just testify from my own experience owning a house, unless you're really rich.
So how's that work,
Jeff? Is really scary.
Mortgage every month, and if you're late 1 month, they're ready to evict you.
Yeah, yes, you start a chain of events that will hurt you. So everything you do is to make sure.
Lord forbid you're late, and you just say, "Hey, no, I'm sorry. This month I'm going to pay last month, and I'm going to pay this month, and I'm back on track." No, they just say, "I'm sorry."
Well, there could be negotiations.
They use that as
there can or cannot be negotiations.
Hey, you missed your chance. Yeah. I'm sorry. Now I get to take your house.
They can start a process of eviction, or I think if you missed 1 month, there'd probably be some sort of negotiation, but you would probably take a hit in your credit rating and probably pay penalties and stuff. Basically, what people do, including us, is that's the bottom line. You pay that mortgage no matter what. So other things are suffering. Because
like
guess
rent.
What?
It's like
yeah,
rent.
Yeah, exactly. Guess what, though? It's unlike rent. It's mortgage plus taxes. And those things are bundled together for most people because the bank, if you have a mortgage, the bank wants the house to be their, it's their property. They consider it their property. So they don't want to default the house to the city from non-payment of property taxes. So
you're paying taxes included with the mortgage.
And that is the killer.
So I'll give you an
that
example.
Is the killer.
800 plus 150. And 150 is taxed.
It's higher than that, but yeah. And that's a killer. And all that's both figures would be higher. Because it's a killer because when you first get a house, you're calculating just the mortgage. And then you realize you have to pay taxes too, and you calculate that. And for us, that meant we were going to still be paying less than we did monthly in rent. But over time, because property taxes keep going up where I live, I don't know why. Water charges going up too, by the way. But let's stick to property tax for a minute. Then you face the real problem. This is how they gentrify towns. If you just keep raising the property taxes, you'll force every working class person out of that town within a few years. You know,
that's what happened in Detroit and Michigan. Well, that,
by neighborhoods, but I'm talking about like entire towns can be emptied out of its working class base, except for the people that already own their property, which is a small minority, and except the people that can keep up with the tax increases, which is a small minority. So, you know, maybe not get rid of all the workers, but get rid of most of them, because that becomes a big figure, lumping taxes in with mortgage payments. All of a sudden, I can't say for sure I'm paying less now. We're paying less now than we would with rent, as bad as rents are. And rents are hugely bad, especially around where this show emanates from, Greater Boston. We're here in Medford, Massachusetts. Somerville, Medford. Rents are really high, and there's no check on them. Rent control, the bosses got rid of rent control. The big corporations, the Democratic Party, made sure rent control was done away with in the 90s in this state, in Massachusetts. And it was only existed in a few cities by that point. So basically you have a situation where, you have that, expense, and then all these other expenses that you kind of, until you experience it, you don't realize how bad it is. Like water charges, like I mentioned, water taxes, basically, other taxes that come up, like excise taxes, the every little repair seems to cost like $1,000. Like,
what about trash?
They've got it down to I think we pay for that, although I'm not even aware of how much that is. I should ask my wife Tina about that. But basically, so you're paying for all these things you didn't like calculate into that you'd pay, and you're paying, and every single repair on the house is a major problem. The contractors have you at a disadvantage, let's say. I was going to use a more colorful metaphor. They have you at a disadvantage. So there's so much demand for contractors, everything from plumbers to electricians to whatever, that they just come in and they just kill you. They just kill you. And they kill you in a very humiliating way. They'll come in, unless you're rich, they'll come in and they'll say, oh yeah, we'll do, here's our estimate, we'll do this. And then, you know, and then they just abandon you. They're like, if they have a more important job, they'll let you hang. That's happening to us right now. We sort of agreed to have something fixed, and they're just like, oh, weather's not good enough, or this or that. And when they first agreed to it, they didn't say anything like that. They were just going to be there, boom, and fix it. And they showed up one day and did a little bit, and then they disappeared. And this happens to a lot of people. And
there's no accountability?
None. Zero.
You pay.
It's all private capitalism. Yeah. And that's why if you ever meet a libertarian in real life, just laugh in their face. Say, you're a joke. You know, the whole thing about the so-called market and exchange of this and that, you're always at a disadvantage when you're a worker. Always, always, you know. And there's no accountability about the prop. There's no real accountability about the property taxes, about the water taxes.
So,
about
Jeff, you pay me $5,000, I did half the job and I just left you.
We don't pay up front. We don't pay up front. At least we didn't have to. Maybe some people do. We got an estimate and they said they'd do this. And then all of a sudden we're just in limbo. They're not showing up. They're not doing the work, et cetera. And of course, we can go to another contractor, but we have a disagreement about that. You know, my wife isn't anxious to do that. I want to do it. It takes time, no matter what. If we try to do it, I mean, your whole life can be spent maintaining a house and all your money, and you just can't afford it. So they call it being house poor, and we're that way, and a lot of people are. So we thought, oh, we're able to scrape together enough money for a house. Yay, and it's a real problem, actually. The house is falling apart. We can't get it fixed. Can't get stuff fixed. Just don't have the money for it. So so anyway, when I read these statistics about who owns stock and how much, and it goes totally counter to what most people think because of the brainwashing of the corporate media, I completely understand it. Like when they say most households had less than $5,000 in total holdings in 2016, I totally get that, you know. Let's see. back to the stock thing, quoting from the article, foreign multinationals and other investors own 35% of all U.S. corporate stock, up 10% from 1982. So in other words, there's this idea out there that individuals own stock, and they do, mostly rich individuals, but they do, that, you know, the top 10% or top 1%. But then how many people understand that 35% is owned by institutions? It has nothing to do with individuals, you know? And also, by the way,
like Harvard?
Yeah, exactly. And how many people understand that not every company issues stock? Stock is a way for a company to borrow more money, in a sense.
So go public, so to speak.
Yeah, go public, so to speak. To borrow more money to expand or to pay for something without any individual liability, by the way. Like if your corporation goes bankrupt, you as a person, as a corporate CEO, pig, capitalist pig, you're out of there scot-free. Nothing happens to you.
Tax hole,
yeah, nothing happens to you. Nothing happens to you. And
well, that was the whole point.
So the corporation, let me just finish that thought real quick. So the corporations are constantly borrowing money from banks, where of course they're favorably treated, and from and issuing shares of stock. So all this money is floating around that's they're not really ultimately liable for. This enormous amount of credit is at their disposal, and then the profits come in from that. That they take in, that they keep, that they or they use some to reinvest or, you know, turn into capital, but a lot of it they of course keep in inflated salaries and so on. Sorry, go ahead. What were you saying?
No, it's like I took economics in high school, and the guy was talking about to go incorporated means is to have a unreliable, like you don't. They don't take your house. They don't sue. You don't get sued for any wrongdoings or whatever.
The CEOs.
And I said, how chief. Sick is that?
Yeah, the corporate board people. Yep.
I had to raise my hand. How sick is that?
Yep.
You know? Yep. You actually have you have a system where it's
protects the wealthiest.
It's like saying, hey, I'm protected. I got the, like in Monopoly, I got the get out of jail free card, you know, on this one.
It protects the exploiters. It protects those that exploit other people's labor and exploit natural resources for their private gain. And they're protected from not only what you're describing, the economic things that might go wrong, you know, but also oftentimes from environmental things that they screw up, which is part of the economy. If you think about it, they escape that stuff too. They escape direct liability a lot of the time. It's very rare for some corporate executive to get caught out, and get into the criminal injustice system over like an environmental issue or whatever. Like there's high profile cases like Erin Brockovich and that whole story of her doing that law and civil action or whatever, that movie that took place around here. Mm-hmm. But those are the exceptions. The rule is that the corporations like. And that part of the economy of environmental destruction and exploitation of natural resources, they often just get they have no liability in what they do, the pollution they do, and so on. But let me just go back to this thing for 1 second. Foreign multinational and other investors own 35% of all United States corporate stock, up from 10% in 1982. What I didn't read, which I'll read now, that share of the pie exceeds the single slice owned by taxable American shareholders, defined benefit plans, defined contribution plans, or nonprofit institutions, Harvard, for example. So, in other words, if you really think of this big picture, Harvard, for example, incredibly wealthy, like, what is it, 40-something billion now in the endowment and all that, a lot of that invested in the stock market, that still pales, that's still not in the big leagues with these multinational and other investors, private investors that own this big chunk of 35%. That's still, you know, you add up all these other people, it's still lower than that. That's mind-boggling stuff. So it's an article that I really, really urge people to read, again, from the New York Times, or website, probably from the paper. Patricia Cohen, February 8th, 2018. Let me just see, there's a couple other, yeah, that's about it. So again, I posted this article on Facebook, and some well-meaning people kind of clued in on the wrong thing, which is the thesis in here that fluctuations in the stock market don't hurt the average worker. And that's really not the main point I was trying to get out of that. I was trying to show people that
the most, myths.
Well, yeah,
breaking the myths.
That we're not a shareholder democracy. Remember, you ever hear that phrase? All the crazy propaganda you hear about working people owning stock. You know, like, for example, during one of the booms in the, I think it was the high-tech boom of the late 90s, I knew someone whose brother, I knew someone in Somerville whose brother, who was a cab driver, had saved up a bunch of money and put it in the stock market. When people do that, you know how long they last?
Not long.
Not long.
Don't put all your eggs. They even tell you investors, don't put all your eggs in one basket. Yeah. So he put all his eggs in one basket.
Within a couple months, he was dead in the water. Lost his life savings. And that happens to individuals. So anyone that buys into that kind of propaganda for real, they are hurt bad. They're hurt really badly. Because you can't... The reason that these big investors, this 35% ownership by foreign investors and other big rich private investors, the reason they survive is because they have a lot of money. So they lose a lot. They gain a lot. They've got other things going on.
See, they can afford it.
You know? Yeah, they can afford the losses when they happen.
It's like when you go gambling, you know, you take $5,000. I can either make it big or I can lose it all. But at least that $5,000 didn't hurt you because you got a million.
Right.
You know what
exactly.
I mean?
Exactly. It's chump change. Yep. Trump change. Anyway, here's an article that I connected to the other article just because, again, myth busting about the United States as the richest country in the world. This is an article from Counterpunch, January 24th, 2018, by W.T. Whitney. I don't know who that is. Let's see who that is. Usually they put a little bio at the end. I'm not sure if that made it onto this one. Nope. We don't know who W.T. Whitney is. Anyway, Counterpunch is a reliable source. Quote, U.S. capitalism lets children and mothers die. So this is really sad, but true. One of the authors of a recent study of U.S. children's deaths told an interviewer that, quote, the U.S. is the most dangerous of wealthy democratic countries. I would put democratic in quotes, but they put it out there. Democratic countries in the world for children. Across all ages and in both sexes, children have been dying more often in the U.S. than in similar countries since the 1980s. This report was published online January 8th in Health Affairs. That's the name of a publication, Health Affairs. 90% of the deaths analyzed were of infants and older adolescents. According to the authors, we examined mortality trends for 20 nations in the OECD, that's the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, for children ages 0 to 19 from 1961 to 2010 using publicly available data. They discovered that over the 50-year study period, the lagging U.S. performance amounted to over 600,000 excess deaths. 600,000. While child mortality progressively declined across all countries, mortality in the U.S. has been higher than in peer nations since the 1980s, they indicate. From 2001 to 2010, for example, the risk of death in the U.S. was 76% greater for infants and 57% greater for children ages 1 through 19. So there's a lot of statistics in here. United States ranking 25th out of 29. In assuring health and safety. African descendant infants in the United States are most at risk for preventable deaths. The overall U.S. infant mortality rate for babies in 2000, for all babies in 2015 was 5.9%. The infant mortality rate is the number of babies dying during their first year of life for every group of 1,000 babies born alive. The IMR, infant mortality rate for white babies, was 4.8. For black and Hispanic babies, 11.4 for black and 5.2 for Hispanics. U.S. mothers are experiencing similar dreadful health outcomes. In the United States, the maternal mortality rate, that's women dying in childbirth, was 16.9, 17.5, and 26.4% each of those years. So it's growing up. And, you know, and we get this news, I don't know.
And that's due because of what, health?
Well.
It has to do with what people eat, or does it have to do also with the environment?
Well, I'm going to get into that in a second, and we're going to have an interesting answer for that. But first, I just want to say, you know, you watch the corporate media, you listen to the radio, corporate media and all that, right? So a usual feature of most corporate media stories, especially on television, is sort of the good newsy technology thing. You know, new technology this, new technology that, to make it seem like, or the new the latest release from Apple or something. It's all supposed to add up to, I think, you know, it's just false propaganda. It's optimistic propaganda. That basically implies that, or explicitly says that, you know, an improvement in health technology, a breakthrough of some sort, will then somehow trickle down magically to the rest of the population, that it will be used properly, etc. Under capitalism, it's inevitable it won't be used properly. It will be used for profitability. Not properly, profitability. And there's this idea also that technology is ever going upward. Things are always getting better. Here we have, in a very basic, very, very basic thing for people having children, the maternal, that's mother's, mortality rate for these 3 years taken out of this study, 1990, 2000, 2015, it increased every single year. And it went from 16.5, 0.9 to 17.5 to 26.4. Now, 26.4 is a quarter of the amount of people they're studying. This is per 100,000 births who die from causes related to childbirth during pregnancy, the birth process, and for 42 days thereafter. In Canada, the comparable figures were in single digits, 6.0, 7.7, 7.3. What do they have in Canada that we don't have?
Healthcare.
Universal national healthcare system. So that's one answer, immediate answer to what you raised.
So you're saying in England, it's lesser?
Canada. So far.
No, but
so
in England that has a national health care system?
It's not in the article yet. They didn't mention England yet.
Okay.
So I'm going to skip over some of that stuff. And this guy then quotes another article. But here he says, this is the other thing, the bigger picture, right? The blame for all this, he says, falls on capitalism. So, for example, in Save the Children's 2015 rankings for overall performance delivering health care to mothers, the United States ended up at 61st place. The richest country in the world ends up at 61st place for delivering health care to mothers. So this author says, which I totally agree with, blame falls upon capitalism. In the recent Monthly Review article, Monthly Review is a socialist website and monthly magazine, John Bellamy Foster and Brett Clark explained that capitalists arrived at a method for accumulating wealth at the expense of women. We think children are losers too. Now, Foster is a socialist. He writes a lot about socialism and the environment. Good stuff. Here they're focusing on women and children. That means Foster and Clark, relied on a process that Marx, Engels, and their followers have labeled, quote, social reproduction, which refers to capitalist need for renewing the workforce. Children are the fodder for social reproduction, and women are the agents, because they have the children. Citing the investigations of others, the Monthly Review authors explain how women and children become sources of accumulation, a task for which capital would seem superficially to be ill-suited. After all, social reproduction differs from the production of commercially valuable commodities through which workers are exploited. But capitalists are resourceful, and those areas outside commodity production, including both the reproduction of labor power and what could be expropriated from nature, were considered free gifts to capital. This is a quote from Marx, free gifts to capital. According to the authors, capital demonstrates a, quote, necessary and continuing attempt to transcend or readjust its boundaries with respect to its external conditions of production. Doing so, it constantly seeks to expropriate, meaning take, what it can from its natural, and social environment. In both situations, it's a matter of actual robbery, usurpation, expropriation, dependence, and enslavement. So in other words, it's the old forcing women or forcing families to do things that are not paid for to keep social reproduction going. Things that might even be taxed, less than paid for, things that they might cost the workers, which it does, obviously, to do. And this creates a lot of free labor under capitalism. And Marilyn Waring, whom they cite, I don't think she's a Marxist or not, says, quote, the treatment of Mother Earth and treatment of women and children in the system of national accounts have many fundamental parallels. Then it goes on, more statistics about children, childhood poverty and so on. The CHIP program and attacks on that. And Vincent Navarro, a veteran public health investigator and economist, suggests the working class forces in the United States are too weak to resist plunder. He points out that the United States is the only major capitalist country without government guaranteed universal health care coverage. And it's the only nation without a social democratic or labor party that serves as the political instrument of the working class and the popular classes. These two facts are related. Navarro notes the juxtaposition of strong labor movements in Europe and relatively small, timid unions in the United States. In general, he observes, if you establish a spectrum of capitalist countries, listing them from very corporate-friendly, like the United States, to very worker-friendly, like Sweden, you find that where the capitalist class is very strong, very poor health benefits coverage in the public as well as private sectors, highly unequal coverage, and very poor health indicators are the case, and this is indeed the case in the U.S. So he makes this point we make on the show a lot, right? The lack of workers' parties, which he's calling social democratic or labor, result in generally poor living standards here, even though it's the richest country in the world, huge inequality, lack of reforms, lack of, you know, even under capitalism, lack of social spending, and lack of class consciousness, even, I would add. So along the same theme, you know how we're talking about the U.S. and saying, well, it's worse than a lot of other countries, and it is, but the same problems that capitalism is forcing upon people is existing internationally. Mm-hmm. So if living standards are falling in the United States, they're also falling in other countries. So here's a quick look at one, if our listeners want to check this out, from The Guardian, January 25th, 7 in 10 UK, you know, British workers are chronically broke, study finds. Economic insecurity is the new normal, with only 30% saying they live comfortably. So economic insecurity has become the new normal in the UK, with at least 70% of the UK working population chronically broke. And this is from a study by the think tank Royal Society of Arts. And it goes on and gives statistics on that. 32% of the UK workers have less than £500 in savings. So it's some of those statistics you're hearing a lot about American workers. They have so little or no savings that if something happens, they have to go deeper into debt or be homeless or whatever. 41% have less than £1,000 in savings. Almost 30% are concerned about their level of debt, while 43% of workers do not have anyone in their household they could depend on to support them financially in the event of hardship. You know, for example, I'm not quoting here, but for example, losing a job. Quote, back to quoting, fewer than half of the employees, 44%, feel that they have progressed in their careers over the last 5 years, and only 40% feel they have good opportunities to progress in the future. That reminds me of what we were talking about earlier. Perceptions, self-perception of how your job is in the United States and how things are going. I wonder how Americans would answer this. Yeah, you're really going to get a raise in the last 10 years, but at least they gave me some more responsibility or something. You know, that's a bad thing, actually, because you're working more for less. You know what I mean? And then you say, do you have opportunities to progress in the future? I think a lot of Americans workers say, yeah, sure. You know, I'll just do this, this, and that. You're not going to do it, man. Classes cost money. Bosses don't want to promote you. You're getting older. You're screwed.
That's like my boss. This month he's supposed to give me a raise. He said he's going to give me a raise or at least a review. But now with this whole prospect of moving on, you know, to some institutional, I won't name on the air, institutional place or places with better wages and better rights.
Maybe.
Maybe. But definitely better than where I'm at now.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say a word. I'm going to see if it comes out of him or not.
Yeah, you know, we'll see.
Which won't. He won't. But it's all right.
So this
here's my last two, my resignation.
Yeah. This is, I like this this phraseology here, so I'm just going to read this real quick. From retail workers to warehouse operatives, from daycare, from care workers to cleaners, we're beginning to uncover the hidden millions who are chronically broke year in, year out. The real danger for this group of workers is all of a sudden a child care bill, unpaid, another rent increase just around the corner. I really like the way they phrased that. Then the article ends with more stats. They break it down. Chronically precarious, acutely precarious, flexi workers, steady staters, idealists. I love this. I do want to go into this. But first, we're going to take a little break, perhaps. First, we have to say this is WMFO Medford, WMFO in Medford. And we'll add that it is 91.5 FM, Tufts Freeform, commercial-free, community-based radio, also known as Tufts Educational Radio. And we're a little slice of that community-based. You're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio. We're here every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., talking music from a working-class, democratic socialist perspective. So should we hit a little music, take a quick break? Is that okay? All right, so we're going to go for some music, and then we'll be right back.
The government has now banned the carrying of spears. Stop about every 1,000 miles ain't asking too much, is it?
You might wish to stay on and listen. It was a place where everything was legal.
I met this woman.
So if you're looking for emotional satisfaction, my advice to you is seek professional help.